The world has changed. Can life survive? Birds that nest under streetlights are stressed. The stress hormone corticosterone was measured in songbirds nesting under white artificial lights, and it was found to be at similar levels to birds who were being caught or handled. The same hormone was found elevated in female wood frogs, triggered by the noise of traffic. Through either the disorientation or a stress response, the increased hum of ambient noise caused a lower percentage of the frogs to find the chorus of breeding male frogs. And even fumes from traffic, along with ozone exposure, can have a direct impact on the neural circuitry of insects. Honeybees exposed to these toxins have displayed greatly reduced memory and even learning ability. However, the picture is not quite so simple, for other species appear to have adapted well to the chaos of the modern world. The London Underground mosquito, for example, has changed from its life of feeding on birds and hibernating in winter. Now it feeds all year round on mice, rats, and humans. Anole lizards of Puerto Rican cities have evolved more tiny, brush-like lamellae on their feet, allowing them to scale walls and even glass windows. We are changing the world around us at a rapid pace, and in many cases, nature is keeping up. But the question is, are we? Humans have built a modern world that is fast becoming totally unlike anything seen before on the Earth. And now we live entrenched within it, not only under artificial light and in the constant hum of traffic, but in vastly different social structures, larger networks, and with frequent triggers for stress or alarm. And so are humans really flexible enough to cope in these bizarre new concrete landscapes? And could an anatomically modern Homo sapiens from hundreds of thousands of years ago, with a body and brain virtually indistinguishable from our own, adapt to our life today? Countless breakthroughs are being made that upend our understanding about our earliest ancestors. And in this golden age of evolutionary discovery, History of Humankind's researchers, writers, and fact-checkers conduct extensive research to give the most cutting-edge window into our origins. It is 2009, and a team of archaeologists are lying face down in a trench in White Sands National Park, New Mexico. They have uncovered footprints that are 23,000 years old. For that time, White Sands was not the desert we know today, but a lush landscape of grassy wetlands around the great paleolake Otero. Here, in a world alive with mammoths, direwolves, and saber-toothed cats, lived a group of humans. One trail of prints appears to show a small number of humans, perhaps just two or three individuals, stalking behind a giant ground sloth. A short distance away, another set of footprints suggests that crowds of adults and children were gathered together, watching as the hunt progressed. Of course, the footprints aren't an exact census, but they seem to suggest small, highly mobile groups of perhaps 20 to 50 individuals, living off the resources the ancient lake provided. And we can see traces of a similar lifestyle in human footprints found at Kubi Fora in Kenya. Again here, evidence seems to suggest around 20 to 50 highly mobile and interdependent individuals. And again, these footprints were made near the shore of an ancient paleolake that could sustain all manner of life. Butchered animal bones show this small group of humans were processing large game with stone tools near the lake's shore. And so clearly, the daily lives of these two groups of humans, in Kenya and North America, may have shared many similarities, and would both stand in stark contrast to the lifestyle most humans live today. However, these footprints are separated by more than just distance, because the human group that lived at Kubi Fora lived 1.5 million years earlier. As far back as ancient Homo erectus, that evolved in Africa around 2 million years ago, we can see elements of a lifestyle that persisted right through to the advent of farming between 10 and 20,000 years ago. Of course, over that span of time, human brains would increase in size, and our technologies and culture would develop. And yet despite this, many aspects of the living experience and daily routine of humans would be similar, despite the truly vast amount of time that passed. Our ancestors hunted and scavenged, surviving in small groups that lived near the resources they required. Their natural world dictated where they lived, and also when their days began. In a world with no blackout blinds or alarm clocks, ancient sleep and wakefulness patterns likely aligned closely to the rising and setting of the sun. In fact, a study from the Sleep and Chronobiology Laboratory at the University of Colorado highlighted the changes in present-day humans' body clocks after as little as 1 week camping. The study investigated the participants' circadian rhythm by measuring the sleep hormone melatonin, and found that campers' circadian clocks shifted 2 hours earlier during the trip. The lead author of the paper suggested that sleeping outside keeps us more in sync with our biology, and went on to run a follow-up study in the cold of winter that showed a more disturbed sleep, but more sleep overall. Indeed, this disturbed but effective sleep is observed in hunter-gatherer societies today. Evolutionary anthropologist David Sampson found the Hadza people of Tanzania would generally perceive they had a good sleep, even if it was disturbed. Helen Ball, director of the Durham Infancy and Sleep Center, has even suggested the idea of one large bank of consolidated sleep has only existed for the last 2 centuries. And so we can envisage the days and nights of ancient humans. But of course, human days didn't always end immediately after the setting of the sun. Burned animal bone and plant material at Wonderwork Cave in South Africa suggests that Homo erectus was using fire around 1 million years ago. Of course, this would have marked a profound transition in human evolution. Where earlier hominins like Australopithecus would have retreated to the trees when the sun went down, groups of Homo erectus could kindle a flame. It would keep them warm, cook high-quality food, and discourage predators. And indeed, ever since then, fire has become a central part of every human community. For example, just 3,000 years after the footprints were made at the Paleolake Otero, researchers at Ohalo, Israel, have found that people built oval brush huts, each constructed around a central hearth. But of course, for most of the preceding million years or more, there were no brush huts. And so for the vast majority of the time humans have been making fires, they were likely kindled in caves or in and around the most rudimentary of structures. And anthropologist Polly Wiesner of the University of Utah argues that firelight effectively created new time. For earlier hominins, after dark there had been little to do but sleep. Fire changed everything. To understand what happened in those firelit hours, Wiesner spent time with hunter-gatherers in South Africa. During the day, she observed that conversation tended to be practical. People would discuss hunting strategies and resource availability, with only a small amount of gossip or small talk. But around the fire at night, something shifted. Talk would turn to deeper subjects, and the camp would gather to sing, dance, and tell stories. For hunter-gatherers, these stories carried practical knowledge about animals, landscapes, and the land around them, but they also transmitted shared identity and social rules. Of course, we must remember that human culture and society changed over time, and it's unlikely Homo erectus, for example, were telling stories around the fire a million years ago. But even in the earliest days of human fire, the fire itself could have been a remarkably strong shared experience. And the setting of the fire may have allowed the practice of storytelling to evolve over time. And what's more, around those fires, lay objects that were useful. Not all materials fossilize well, so it's hard to inventory what possessions our hunter-gatherer ancestors owned. But it is important to note the relatively few forms the surviving material culture of humans more than 100,000 years ago take. Most items are practical, such as stone tools for hunting and butchering, or ostrich eggshells for storing and carrying water. And of course, this makes sense, given that every possession has to be carried in a nomadic or semi-nomadic lifestyle, so every possession has to earn its place. Anthropologist Marshall Salins called early hunter-gatherers the original affluent society, suggesting they were able to satisfy their material needs, what he called affluence without abundance. And indeed, although ancient hunter-gatherers lived physically demanding lives, exposed to the elements and at risk of predation, perhaps there was a more straightforward nature to the challenges they faced in daily life. In general, their problems would have been immediate ones, which creates very different activity in the human brain. Neuroscientist Judson Brewer has shown that when people train themselves to focus on the present moment through meditation, activity in the brain's default mode network, the system responsible for rumination and self-referential thought, drops significantly. It's tempting to wonder if, for our ancestors, acquiring a default mode network was simply the norm. Without the complex challenges of the modern world, their lived experience would certainly be a very different one. And so, these were the hunter-gatherer lives our ancestors lived a version of for over a million years. Culture did evolve over time, but huge aspects of their daily lives kept similarities and contrasts with the lifestyles most of us live today. But around 12,000 years ago, something changed. For the first time in the long history of our genus, people began to farm the land and settle in permanent homes. The cultivation of wild plants gradually became true domestication as humans became increasingly dependent on cereals and grains. And this Neolithic revolution would not only change our behavior, but even our very DNA. In a paper published in Nature in April 2026, researchers found that many alleles, variants of a gene that produces different traits in different individuals, changed after farming began. The strongest signals involve immune-related regions, likely influenced by the increased spread of disease within more densely populated towns and cities. Others include traits linked to metabolism. One gene led to a lowering of body mass in more recent generations, probably due to the surplus of calories associated with crop domestication. And so the ancient hunter-gatherer lifestyle, what we can see pieces of from Kubifora to White Sands, would come to an end. And so this is the world our ancient human ancestors from 100,000 years ago would have lived in. They would have lived their whole life by the light of the sun, moon, stars, or fire. They would have lived in small, tight-knit social groups. They would have had few possessions, and likely experienced the world without an overactive default mode network in his mind. And so if we want to transport one of these prehistoric humans 90,000 years into his future, straight into the Neolithic Revolution, his new surroundings would offer a mixture of challenges to adapt to. An abundance of food stores, yes, but greater risk of disease, and the beginning of a whole new, sedentary way of life. But of course, we know that generations of real humans did adapt to this shift, changing their very genetic makeup over the following thousands of years. Perhaps this ancient human would cope, perhaps not. But of course, a lot has happened since then, and taking him 100,000 years into the future, into our time, would be very different. And so his journey will be like our own, not stopping at the Neolithic Revolution, but continuing to push on through eras of ever-advancing technology, societies, and ways of life that get further and further from the ones he evolved for. In the 1980s, children play on a roof that is 14 stories high, for it is one of the only sunny places in Kowloon Walled City. Below them, people walk the tunnel-like alleyways. Many of them clutch umbrellas in the darkness, not to protect from rain, but from the dripping of thousands of corroded pipes. The city is a knotted maze of iron and concrete, with some of its streets formed by vast amounts of rubbish, caught in nets and trodden into a new walkway between buildings. A single postman covers this entire city, and it's not that far to go as it's only a hundredth of a square mile in size. But within that tiny footprint are over 8,000 premises, 10,000 households, and 30,000 people. Beginning as an abandoned military fort, Kowloon grew organically into a truly unique city that would eventually be demolished in 1993. And indeed, before its demise, Kowloon Walled City was known as the densest place on Earth. In In the modern world, censuses tell us that half of all humans live in cities. What's more, surveys show that the average person in developed nations like the US and the UK spend around 87% of their time indoors and 6% in vehicles. That means we spend only 7% of our entire lives outside. Most of our time is spent inside climate-controlled boxes, in a sense disconnected from natural rhythms of daylight, weather, and terrain. And this mismatch between the lives we evolved for and the way we live in the modern world has been developing for thousands of years. In evolutionary psychology, a mismatch refers to the difference between the selective pressures that shaped humankind over millions of years and the novel conditions of modern environments, leading to potentially suboptimal outcomes like disease, stress, and maladaptive behaviors. Today, the average working week globally is around 33 hours, with some regions hitting 50 or 60. But some ethnographic studies of people living in extant foraging communities, like the Khoeng San of South Africa, show that the average hunter-gatherer works only 15 hours a week. This equates to just a few hours every day hunting, fishing, gathering, making, or mending. The rest of their time is theirs to do with as they please. And indeed, for more than 90% of our species' history, humans likely lived in a very similar way. But the change away from this truly accelerated in the Industrial Revolution, when rural farmlands gave way to factories and tenement slums, turning settled villages into crowded megacities and cementing our separation from the wild, physical world that shaped us. And it was during this time that French sociologist Émile Durkheim observed something about society. The more industrialized life became, the more it seemed to come apart at the seams. Durkheim noticed that as people left their small, tightly knit communities for anonymous city streets and factory floors, they lost their sense of shared rules, expectations, and obligations. Durkheim called this phenomenon anomie. Anomie is a sense of normlessness. It's what you feel when the rules that tell you what to hope for, how much to want, and how to behave no longer seem to apply. In a period of rapid change like the Industrial Revolution, old traditions quickly crumbled and new ones didn't have time to form. Durkheim was especially struck by the way this normlessness showed up in the statistics of his time. For as railways, stock markets, and factories spread across European nations and beyond, suicide rates climbed. For Durkheim, the problem was not just poverty or hardship, but a deep mismatch between human minds and the rapidly changing social world they were being thrust into. Industrialization, therefore, was a significant driver of evolutionary mismatch, but it wasn't the sole cause in modern life. Today, many mammals are nocturnal or crepuscular, meaning that they are most active after the sun has set. When mammals first evolved during the Triassic, they shared the world with dinosaurs, many of which were diurnal or most active during the day. By sleeping in the day and waking at night, early mammals could avoid predation and other dinosaur-related dangers. But after non-avian dinosaurs went extinct around 66 million years ago, mammals started to diversify. Since there were very few large predators left after the Cretaceous mass extinction, several mammal families began to shift towards diurnal lifestyles. They evolved sharper daytime vision and internal circadian clocks fine-tuned to bright light wavelengths. One of these families were the ancestors of modern monkeys, apes, and humans, and so our lineage evolved to be awake during the day and asleep during the night. But once electricity became available, our days no longer had to stop when it got dark or when the weather turned. Factories and offices could run longer hours, and later computers and the internet made it possible to work at almost any given time. From an evolutionary standpoint, humans are built for bursts of effort punctuated by genuine downtime, not for continuous engagement with tasks around the clock. And so while our ancestors expended energy in targeted physical bursts, followed by rest around the fire, today we sit for 8 to 12 hours at desks, in cars, or on couches. Constant access to power has created constant demands on attention, erasing the line between on and off. The result has been chronic stress, low energy, and less time or motivation to cook, move, and recover. In the mid-20th century, endocrinologist Hans Selye noticed this mismatch becoming more prevalent in society, and he came up with something called general adaptation syndrome to describe how animals respond to prolonged strain. This syndrome is a byproduct of the natural three-stage response to stress. The first stage, alarm, triggers the classic fight-or-flight reaction, flooding the body with adrenaline and cortisol. The second, resistance, engages coping mechanisms to maintain balance despite ongoing stress. Afterwards, the third stage, exhaustion, sets in, leading to breakdown, vulnerability, and burnout. Imagine an Australopithecus, like the famous Lucy, living somewhere around 3.2 million years ago in the wooded grasslands of what is now Ethiopia. Picture her group facing a sudden crisis, a leopard ambush near their leafy home. Her body reacts perfectly. Her heart races, adrenaline and cortisol floods her system, and her muscles tense for a desperate climb into the branches or a sprint across the savannah. She and her group make it to safety, and their brief period of alarm fades. The stress system resets, conserving energy for the next day's foraging, and so Lucy's system is perfectly matched to brief life-or-death pulses in a dangerous but episodic world. Fast forward to today, that same ancient machinery grinds without release. In the constant hum of modern life, it can become a slow but steady source of mental exhaustion. And a century or so of industrialized living has not only assaulted our mental state, but our physical state too. During the early 20th century, developed nations began to face what physicians called diseases of civilization. For most of human history, the main threats to life were infections, injuries, and famine. In small, mobile bands of hunter-gatherers, people faced parasites, dangerous animals, wounds, and the risks of childbirth. Early farmers added new problems, like close contact with livestock and poor sanitation, which made diseases like smallpox, tuberculosis, and measles part of everyday life. Over the 20th century, things seemed to improve dramatically. Clean drinking water, sewer systems, vaccination, antibiotics, and safer childbirth drove infectious disease and infant mortality down to historic lows in many developed countries, while average life expectancy shot up. But as the old killers retreated, new ones took their place. Today, in high-income nations, the leading causes of death are not infections, but chronic, non-communicable diseases like heart attacks and strokes, clogged arteries, type 2 diabetes, obesity-related conditions, and many forms of cancer. And so why do humans living in modern, urban settings fall victim to these diseases of civilization? In 1962, geneticist James Neal proposed the idea of a thrifty genotype. He suggested that our hunter-gatherer ancestors evolved genes that made their bodies exceptionally efficient at storing energy. This thrifty adaptation would have been put to the test during the last glacial maximum, the height of which occurred around 27 to 20,000 years ago. This was a time when massive ice sheets covered most of the northern hemisphere, and food scarcity would likely have hit brutal extremes. This meant that humans that could rapidly store fat from rare kills, then ration it through famine, were far more likely to survive these periods of extreme scarcity. But those same genetic tendencies that once protected people from starvation now leave many of us vulnerable to abundance. Indeed, in modern developed nations, we have constant access to food. Much of it is cheap, high in calories, and ultra-processed. However, the human body still behaves as though scarcity is just around the corner, storing excess energy rather than burning it off. Combine this with sedentary lifestyles and long hours spent under artificial light, and the result is a physiological mismatch between an ancient metabolism and a modern environment designed for excess. And yet even though we are surrounded on all sides by abundance, abundant food, abundant stimulation, abundant people, in many ways we are becoming more isolated than our distant ancestors ever were. When Michiko Kamiyama shut the apartment door behind her, she thought she was making the right choice. She'd told her 8-year-old daughter, Julianne, that she was going out for a while and reminded her not to open the door for anyone. Kamiyama had come to the United States years before with her husband, But then he had died, leaving her alone with a small child in a foreign country. And so she did what she could to survive, including working long hours as a waitress. However, it wasn't enough to pay the bills in 1990s California, and feeling the pressure, she applied for a second job as a singer in a lounge bar. Unable to find a babysitter, Kamiyama went for an audition and left Julianne alone in their apartment. But her daughter was alone for a total of half an hour before Kamiyama got a call from the police. A neighbor had heard the girl crying and alerted the authorities. Kamiyama rushed home, but Julianne had already been taken by Child Protection Services, and Kamiyama was arrested and jailed. Michiko Kamiyama faced choices that would have been unthinkable for our ancestors, and she was far from alone in facing this kind of strain in modern times. For most living hunter-gatherer groups, however, infants receive hours of close, responsive contact each day from dozens of caregivers. Everyone chips in, including older siblings, grandparents, aunts, uncles, and even neighbors. Anthropologists call this alloparenting, and it appears to be a core human adaptation. Caring for another parent's offspring is rare in the animal kingdom, found in only 9% of bird species and about 3% of mammal species. Indeed, within the primate lineage, other than in humans, alloparenting is only truly found within our distant relatives of marmosets and tamarins. But despite this, American anthropologist and primatologist Sarah Hurdy believes that our ancestors began to alloparent over a million years ago, in the time of Homo erectus. As well as allowing skilled parents time to conduct tasks for the group, Hurdy also believes this variety of care gave young hominins challenges unlike any other ape, creating a selection pressure for heightened social ability. Today, however, much more common than alloparenting are sole caregivers that are also in full-time employment. In fact, across many wealthy countries, surveys show that a significant number of employed adults work multiple jobs. In the United States, labor statistics show that roughly 8 or 9 million people hold more than one job at the same time, with women and young adults the most likely to be moonlighting. And global surveys paint an even starker picture. A 2025 workforce report found that 23% of workers worldwide held two or more jobs. And as well as this, most of them reported living paycheck to paycheck despite the extra work. Of course, these problems and resulting behaviors would be truly alien for anyone who had always lived a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. Indeed, for many living hunter-gatherer groups, who live the kind of lives our species is more adapted for, daily life is organized around strong community ties, resource sharing, and an active resistance to steep hierarchies and wealth inequality. Among the Hadza in Tanzania and the Kung in the Kalahari, successful hunters do not gain prestige by hoarding meat all for themselves. They earn it by sharing it and being humble about their achievements. In these communities, people are expected to share food and other resources with everyone else. Anyone who tries to keep too much for themselves is teased, gossiped about, and openly criticized. Personal property does exist, especially for things like tools and weapons, but there is very little accumulation of durable wealth. Anthropologists sometimes describe these groups as egalitarian or immediate return societies. They do not store resources, so one person can't have much more than anyone else. There is still conflict now and then, but in a very real sense, these hunter-gatherer societies, with their small groups and clear expectations, are much closer to what our minds evolved for. And indeed, as the 20th century became the 21st, small groups and clear expectations would become more and more alien to our day-to-day lives. Imagine a teenager posting a short video to social media. It's nothing special, and they don't expect anyone other than friends and family to see it. But by morning, the video has 10,000 views. The following evening, it has 100,000. The teenager has unwittingly found themselves at the center of a huge amount of attention, and they have no idea what to do about it. The only thing that seems to make sense is to post again. This is the variable reward cycle, and it is the same mechanism that makes slot machines so difficult to walk away from. Each like, flattering comment, or new follower is an unpredictable, intermittent hit of positive feedback that locks social media dependency in place. But it wasn't the internet that created our sensitivity to this kind of feedback. The root is far more ancient. In the small bands our ancestors lived in, knowing where you stood with the people around you was a matter of survival. Approval could have meant the difference between life and death, and so modern social media simply takes advantage of this ancient human instinct. Systematic reviews of social media and our psychological well-being find that the relationship between the two are not straightforward. Indeed, social media is not always harmful. For some people, it provides genuine social support and a space to explore personal identity. But there are also consistent patterns of harm, and they cluster around two things in particular: how social media platforms are used and how much. When humans endlessly scroll through curated images of people who seem more attractive, more successful, and more fulfilled than we are, something in us registers it as a deficit. In fact, even the basic premise of social media might be one that our brains are not built to handle. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, British anthropologist Robin Dunbar was studying primates when he noticed something interesting. Across different species, there was a remarkably consistent relationship between the size of the neocortex and the size of the social groups those species typically lived in. The bigger the neocortex relative to the rest of the brain, the larger and more complex the social group the animal could manage. Dunbar's argument was that primate brains, including our own, didn't grow large primarily to solve technical problems like making tools or navigating landscapes. He proposed that they grew large, above all, to handle the demands of social life. The kind of social tracking that primates do is extraordinarily demanding on cognition, so it appears to have been a primary driver of the expansion of the primate brain over millions of years. And when Dunbar applied this relationship to humans, he proposed that there is an upper limit to the number of stable, meaningful social relationships that the human brain can realistically maintain at one time. This has since become known as Dunbar's number, and it seems to correspond surprisingly well to real-world social structures. From hunter-gatherer bands and Neolithic villages to modern offices, factories, and military companies, groups of roughly 150 people appear again and again across human history and cultures. Anything beyond that number, Dunbar argues, humans can't cope. And now consider what social media asks the brain to do. Even a relatively modest social media presence routinely exposes a person to more faces, names, opinions, and social signals in a single scrolling session than our ancestors would have encountered in a lifetime. Our brains, however, don't know the difference. They try to process all this extra social information as if every notification is a social event and every comment is a status symbol. The processing happens automatically, relentlessly, in the background of everything else we do. And so, where does this all leave us? We're a species shaped by millions of years of evolution for a world that no longer exists. We are built for small groups and intimate knowledge of the people around us, but we live among millions of strangers. We are built for immediate return lives, where effort and reward are closely linked, but we now inhabit economies that demand a constant striving towards goals that recede faster than we can chase them. And this is the world that our ancient Homo sapiens, taken from 100,000 years ago, would land in. Supposing for a moment he could learn modern language and gestures, could get used to wearing clothes and opening cans and bottles, what then? If we grant him those capabilities, could he adapt to a world of long, artificially lit workdays? Or would his ancient mind collapse under the new challenges? And indeed, similarly, are all humans destined to feel the strain of evolutionary mismatch forever? Or could we one day fully adapt to this modern world? In the late 1990s, neuroscientist Dr. Eleanor Maguire climbed into a black cab. She was running behind schedule and asked the driver to go as fast as possible. However, 5 minutes into the journey, Maguire glanced up from the research notes she was reading and spotted a line of cars caught in a traffic jam. She groaned to herself, dreading to think how much longer the congestion was going to set her back. But to her surprise, her cab driver turned onto a side street, completely bypassing the traffic up ahead. He then took them down a network of back roads and cobbled lanes that Maguire had never seen before, despite having lived in London for several years. But what impressed her most was that her driver never once needed to look at a map. And so Maguire asked the driver how he knew where to go, and he told her about the vast mental map he had built up during his years as a London cabbie. As a neuroscientist researching spatial memory, Dr. Maguire immediately started to wonder how exactly these mental maps worked. And a couple of years after that journey, in the year 2000, she published a groundbreaking study. In it, she scanned the brains of a group of London cab drivers and compared them to scans of a control group. The control group were ordinary people of equivalent health and intelligence, but the key difference was that they did not drive cabs. And Maguire found a striking difference between the two groups. The cab drivers had a significantly larger posterior hippocampus than the non-drivers. This part of the brain is used in navigation and spatial memory, and the size of the posterior hippocampus in the cab drivers grew relative to their years on the job. This graded relationship demonstrated an experience-dependent effect. It wasn't that people with naturally enlarged hippocampi became cab drivers, it was the process of navigating a city from memory that reshaped their brains. And as well as this, the front part of the hippocampus in the cab drivers was slightly smaller than in the control group, suggesting that the enlarged posterior hippocampus came with a trade-off. In a follow-up study, Maguire and her colleagues compared the cab drivers with London bus drivers. Both had to navigate a large metropolis, but the bus drivers followed the same route every day. The researchers gave both groups a series of cognitive tests, including tasks that measured different kinds of memory. On tests that required navigating around a virtual London or recalling the layout of routes, the cab drivers outperformed the bus drivers, but on other tasks, they actually did worse. When the researchers tested their ability to form new associations or remember lists of unrelated information, the cab drivers underperformed compared to the bus drivers. The very patterns of brain restructuring that boosted their navigational skills appeared to come with subtle costs to other forms of memory. The human brain is flexible, and scientists call this flexibility neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity is the brain's ability to grow, change, and adapt. Unlike most other organs, the brain can reorganize and rewire itself in response to environmental changes, injuries, illnesses, or disorders, or more positively, learning new things. For a long time, scientists have believed that this flexibility belonged almost entirely to childhood, and once the brain set in adulthood, it became more or less fixed. We now know, however, that this just isn't true. Adult brains remain plastic too, just in a different way. They can still form new connections, strengthen or weaken old ones, and even shift functions to new regions when circumstances demand it. Indeed, every time you learn a new skill at work, recover after an injury, or slowly get used to a new environment or routine, your brain is reshaping itself. This ability to adapt is an essential part of being human, and it's why small bands of Homo sapiens could leave Africa, cross deserts and icy tundra, and still find ways to live. Throughout the history of our species, Homo sapiens have experienced several severe population bottlenecks, driving us perilously close to extinction. But no matter the cause of these sudden plummets in population numbers, whether it be rapid climate change, competition with other hominin species, or even natural disasters, Homo sapiens has always bounced back. And if anything, these brushes with extinction have made our species stronger than ever, because natural selection favored individuals who could learn quickly, improvise, and switch strategies when environments shifted. Some researchers even think the differences in how flexible our learning and social networks were may have been the thing that tilted the balance in our species' favor. Archaeological evidence continuously shows us that our closest human relatives, the Neanderthals and Denisovans, were probably not inferior to us in terms of their intelligence. And this is reflected in the material culture they left behind, in complex tools, cave paintings, and jewelry. but the key difference between our species may have been in how plastic or moldable our brains were. Homo sapiens may simply have had greater capacity for learning and behavioral flexibility, meaning that our ancestors could adapt to a wider range of situations. And so human neuroplasticity likely evolved hundreds of thousands of years ago, and we can see it helping us adapt to modern challenges today, and not just in the mental maps of cab drivers. Although rare in prehistory, there probably were still some instances of language learning for our ancestors. When Homo sapiens migrated out of Africa into Europe and Asia, they would have encountered Neanderthals and Denisovans. These species were closely related to our own, but they had evolved in isolation for thousands of years, and surely would have had their own ways to communicate. Our Homo sapiens ancestors, therefore, would have needed to learn how to speak with them, and vice versa. But of course, this wouldn't have been anything like the demand for bilingualism or multilingualism that the modern world demands. Our societies are increasingly global, and switching between languages is a part of daily life for more and more people. And indeed, neuroscientists have started to see the effects of this in the brains of children. When researchers scan the brains of children who speak more than one language, they often find that certain regions show greater gray matter density than in children who grow up with only one language. Gray matter is where the brain's processing power is concentrated. It's made up of densely packed cells that do the hard work of thinking, deciding, and remembering. In bilingual children, this gray matter appears thicker or more developed. It's as if the daily effort of choosing the right language at the right time nudges these regions to grow a little more, to wire up a little more efficiently. And brain plasticity also helps us with something that would have probably baffled our very early ancestors. For most of human history, nobody read books, scanned text on signs, typed on keyboards, or scribbled down notes. Like in many indigenous populations around the world, stories and knowledge were carried in voices, gestures, and memories, not in lines of ink. And so literacy is a remarkably recent invention in evolutionary terms. The oldest known written document ever found was recovered from the Sumerian city of Kish in modern-day Iraq, dating to the 4th millennium BCE. And yet, in the modern world, literacy is almost as essential as knowing how to find food or shelter once was. The written word is everywhere, and our neuroplasticity has let us adapt the same neural machinery that once helped our hunter-gatherer ancestors survive to read it. When neuroscientists compare the brains of literate and illiterate adults, they can see clear traces of what it takes to bolt this new skill onto an old brain. For it turns out, learning to read systematically reshapes regions in the ventral visual temporal cortex. As we practice turning marks on a page into sounds and meanings, these regions become finely tuned to letter shapes and word forms, and their connections with language areas in the temporal and frontal lobes grow stronger and more efficient. And so, when we look at mental maps, written and spoken language, we can see the plasticity of the human brain helping us adapt to the modern world. And when it comes to other challenges, such as facing the general adaptation syndrome of prolonged strain, or dealing with social groups far above the size of Dunbar's number, there is every chance it is helping us there as well. But no studies have yet been undertaken on the brains of parents that work long hours at multiple jobs. But from what we have seen, it seems likely that neuroplasticity would be at work in situations like these also. To some degree, our brain's plasticity is helping us all adapt to the changes of the modern world. But of course, we shouldn't forget, the modern world has also come with a great many benefits. Average life expectancy has rocketed, and infant mortality has cratered. And all this has been achieved even with the looming threat of evolutionary mismatches like diseases of civilization. Indeed, despite the strain some modern inventions can cause, they are at heart useful situations to problems, an extension of the very first chopping, scraping, and pounding stone tools made millions of years ago. Despite the mismatches social media can cause, the ability to find community with the press of a button can help us fill a social need that has existed for hundreds of thousands of years. And so in this sense, there is a complex interplay between the technology we create and the benefits and mismatches it presents us. The human story has been unfolding for millions of years, a tale of behavioral flexibility and invention so unique it would come to test the very flexibility that made it all possible. And so then, how would our ancient Homo sapiens fare, trying to adapt to our modern world? It would obviously be quite a shock, both physically and culturally. But what we do know for sure is that his brain would make some steps in trying to adapt to the new tasks, new ways of thinking. His brain, like ours, would still have plasticity. It wouldn't remain the same brain that had existed 100,000 years ago. A few years of new experiences and it would be physically changed forever. But what would happen if he then returned? Could those changes be undone? In the 21st century, we find ourselves adapting and surviving in a world that feels as if technology is rapidly accelerating all around us. Is there any way that we could go back to a simpler time? In 2022, a group of Australian researchers grew a brain in a petri dish. Affectionately called dish brain, it was grown from a cluster of human and mouse brain cells. The researchers wanted to see if it could react to external stimulation and modify its behavior. And to do this, the team came up with a test. They taught it to play a computer game. By wiring up the petri dish to the game Pong, a 2D tennis-like game, the researchers taught dish brain where the ball was and rewarded it with electrical stimulation every time the ball was hit. Remarkably, it took less than 5 minutes for the brain cells to learn what they needed to do, and dish brain quickly began to play the game on its own. Of course, dish brain wasn't a full brain. It was a cluster of about 1 million living neurons on a silicon electrode array the size of a postage stamp. But just 2 centuries after the Industrial Revolution, a blink of the eye in evolutionary terms, such wild possibilities are becoming reality. Ancient inventions, like the hand axe or the spear thrower, took thousands of years to appear in the archaeological record, and then thousands more years to be replaced by new, improved technologies. Hand axes especially were around for almost 2 million years before they were eventually replaced by new kinds of tools. Modern technologies, however, change at breakneck pace by comparison. Indeed, in less than 100 years, computers have gone from huge, costly machines that would fill a room to devices that nearly everyone in the modern world carries around with them in their pockets. And so why does the path of our invention follow this exponential shape? Human evolution has a very peculiar quirk. Like other organisms, we evolve biologically through the gradual process of natural selection, but we also have a second kind of evolution, the evolution of culture. Very few other animals show anything similar, and none do on the same scale or with the same complexity as humans. Chimpanzees, whales, and some birds pass on local traditions, but their toolkits and behaviors change at a glacial pace compared with ours. Human cultural evolution, by contrast, can transform how we live within as little as a generation. New ways of doing things can spread across continents in years rather than millennia, and our descendants inherit not just our genes, but our languages, technologies, and institutions. For decades, researchers puzzled over the question of why human culture seems to accumulate and accelerate rather than simply drifting. And psychologist Michael Tomasello proposed a neat answer using an idea borrowed from economics. Back in the 1960s, 2 British economists coined the term ratchet effect to describe how public spending tended to work after a crisis. They observed that budgets would rise to meet the emergency, and afterwards they rarely fell all the way back down. Like a mechanical ratchet, they clicked up a new level and stayed there. And so in the 1990s, Tomasello suggested that a similar ratchet is at work in human culture. When people invent a new tool, technique, or an idea, it doesn't simply vanish when they die. Others copy it, improve it, and combine it with other different innovations. Indeed, once a community has mastered something like fire making, or bronze smelting, or the motor engine, it is very unlikely to revert permanently to a state where that knowledge never existed. This means that each generation starts from the accumulated achievements of the previous ones and pushes them a little further. This works because human cultures are shared and cumulative. We don't just learn by trial and error on our own. We watch, imitate, teach, and correct each other. Knowledge is stored in stories, rituals, recipes, blueprints, and now in vast digital archives. As long as a community remains connected enough to pass these things on, culture clicks forward like a ratchet, making it hard for our collective know-how to slip all the way back to zero. And some clicks of the ratchet have been larger than others. In the late 19th century, people like Thomas Edison were learning how to harness the power of electricity to improve everyday life. And within a few decades, that mastery of electrons set the stage for something new: electronic computation. Early machines like ENIAC in the 1940s filled whole rooms and could only be used by teams of specialists who needed to rewire computer panels by hand. These behemoths were essentially giant calculators built for specific, heavy-duty number-crunching tasks. They were also surprisingly fragile and eye-wateringly expensive. And yet once they had been brought into existence, there was no going back. Just like our ancient ancestors learning how to make fire or inventing a new kind of stone tool, the ratchet effect took hold and drove upward progress. Of course, it also helps that the modern world has an order of magnitude more people in it than the Paleolithic world. Back then, the entire population of Homo sapiens probably numbered only in the low millions, at most. For much of the Pleistocene, it may have been closer to a few hundred thousand. Yet today, there are over 8 billion of us, and that number is set to increase to 10 billion in the next few decades. This means there will not only be more minds available to form new ideas, but vastly more chances for those ideas to be developed and improved. In this sense, human culture has more hands on it than ever before, so there's no reason to expect technology will do anything but continue to accelerate. The future of humankind, therefore, will likely be defined by accelerating, irreversible dependence on increasingly complex interconnected systems. And so, as human society becomes more and more dependent on complex technology, the mismatch between the stable, small-band hunter-gatherer lives we evolved for and the accelerating churn of modern existence could grow much wider in the near future. As the ancient Homo sapiens brought forward from 100,000 years ago ages in our world, he, like us, would be confronted with technologies and a lifestyle that rapidly changes every decade. And even if he had managed to partially adapt, there would come a time when his children would be more suited to the world. Raised around newer technologies, using them when their brains are at their most plastic, they would certainly be better placed to live and innovate in our modern times. As digital technology advances, the stage is now set for the next generations of inventive human minds to decide the course of our future. How it will look is uncertain, but its shape will be decided by the cumulative work of our species. And this species, Homo sapiens, has so far managed to adapt to anything it has ever faced. You've been watching The Entire History of Humankind. Don't forget to like and subscribe and leave us a comment to tell us what you think. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.